I would massively appreciate if you enjoy this podcast that you would leave a review or just hit 5 stars, ideally, or 1 star, if that's how you feel about it. I do appreciate honest feedback. Thank you so much.
Have we met before, Tor?
Well, I don't think so. No, you're just one of those legendary Shetland figures. I can't believe I didn't interview you before, because back in the day, must have been maybe, was it 2017? I started a podcast for the Shetland Times. I don't think they kept it up, but I must have done 10 or 15 interviews. I interviewed like Ali Bain, and I think Norman Lamont was one of my interviews.
That's the one I hear. Yeah. Yeah. I remember you interviewed him. He's a pompous old bugger. And I remember him saying, "You don't sound like a Shetlander." What the hell does he think he sounds like?
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, bringing back my childhood trauma of being considered an English hippie kid in Shetland.
But I'll tell you, Tor, I think I half met you when you were probably quite small. Yeah. In 1987, and I was working with the Shetland Fishermen's Association, and your dad was always a member with a sport. And in 1987, I stood for Parliament for the Shetland Movement, Orkney and Shetland Movement. And we tried to go around all the islands, and Gibby Fraser from West Burraford took my wife and I, Wilma, into Papa Stewart in his boat. And then we left our car at the ferry pier because the ferry in the afternoon was going to take us back. And your mum and dad very kindly took us to their house and gave us lunch, which was very kind of them. And I remember you and your, well, the three the boys, and then is Luke the oldest one?
No, he's the other way around. He's the youngest. He's still in Shetland all the time. He works for NHS in Shetland.
That's right. And he makes the pretty crofters. Yeah. So we bought some from him because I remember he was at the hostel at the time. Would that be right? Because one of the brothers, your mum and dad, asked if we could take them, give them a lift into Lerwick, which we didn't on our way back.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one that could have been. It could have been me, but I just...
So 87,
I would have been at the high school then, so I would have been there from 1985 onwards, so it might have been me.
So it might have been you, yeah. Clearly our road trip from, if it was you, clearly our road trip from the ferry to Lerwick was completely unmemorable.
Well, no, it's probably more like there was one particularly memorable trip with a local who I'm not going to name because he sadly passed away, but he used to drink a hell of a lot. And then on a Sunday, I'd get a lift with him from West Burraford up to the bus. And I would get on the Princess Rose, Pat Eisbester's bus. And he would be so hammered some weeks. I shouldn't laugh, but it was just those were the days. He'd be so hammered that he'd have to stop his car and get out and stagger around a bit and take a few breaths passing place. So that has kind of clouded any other memories of going to that, like getting that lift from West Burraford. Like that's the only memory I have. So I'm 50 this year. And I think, maybe because I used to fight and get punched in the head when I in my 20s, but my memory is not what it should be.
No, and we were in Papa. I hadn't been back for years, and then we've got a little sailboat, and we were in last year. We were at Hamnavoe the year before, just anchored. And then last year we came into Husavoe and spent a day and walked around. And I'd forgotten what a beautiful island it is and how fertile it is.
Yeah.
I'm working on another book at the moment, doing some research, and it's going to be about, Viking Shetland and how Shetland's gone one direction and Faroe's gone the other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Papa, as you well know, was a hugely important place in Viking Shetland, hugely important. And, you know, when you see the wealth of that agricultural land and that famous Vagalan poem about the Rowan Fula Doon, about how they smelt the flowers in that valley. And I always thought that was fiction. And then I don't know if you know a guy called Gordon Smith, originally a fisherman from Hamnavoe. He skippered the Papa Ferry for a few years. And he said on a lovely summer day, he'd actually smelt that coming in. So
yeah, no, I thought that was, I did think that was real. Yeah. You mentioned, you keep saying small. You don't, you can say piri to me, you know, I can
piri,
understand.
Yeah, what, yeah.
So what's your, tell me about this boat, your piri, yeah, sail, you mentioned. What is
well,
it?
Well, I've got two books in the planning at the moment. I mean, on piri, I mean, I'm speaking English, Tor, because this has been recorded and it's going to go out. And I kind of treat the language, I either speak Shetland or I speak English, and I treat the two as separate. But I'm doing research at the moment on two books. One is the increasingly angry interface between the seafood industry and the environmental movement, you know, the FPMA thing in Scotland. I'm obviously coming from one side of the argument, but I'm trying to be as objective as I can because, you know, seafood industry has lots of things it's not doing right. It's got to get better. So I'm working on that. But the other one I'm also working on is the kind of looking at Shetland's, where Shetland is kind of politically, and look at where Faroe is and Iceland is, and we were once part of this Nordic kingdom. And, you know, where's the future of Shetland? Is it going to continue to be a remote island group that's often placed in a map in the Murray Firth, which continues at the whim of a government in London or a government in Edinburgh? Or are we going to try and take some control over our own affairs? Are we big enough to do it? Are we confident enough to do it? Are we able enough to do it? Is there enough young people or people with fire in their belly to do that in Shetland? And then look at the Faroese example, where they went from a population of, when Shetland had a population of over 30,000 in 1860, the Faroese population was 15,000. They're now on the brink with 50,000 people of becoming an, in, you know, they've more control than the Scottish Parliament has. They're now on the brink with a couple of independence parties of becoming a sovereign nation with a seat at the UN.
Yeah.
Where we, you know, the contrast is just huge. So I want to bring that out. And one of the great stories I want to use is the one that appears in Barbara Crawford's book about this incredibly fiery woman in Papastua, Ragnhild, forget her surname, who took on the king's representative on Easter Day in 1150. And, you know, what an empowered, confident woman that must have been to dress the king's representative. No, and I want to use that as an example of kind of, you know, the idea that women can't go up and up helly ass is beyond preposterous when you look back at that history, although it is changing. And I want to look back at that level of confidence in a place like Papa, and where are we now? So I kind of weave in that kind of stories. So that's kind of what I'm thinking.
That sounds amazing. And I'll just declare myself cured of politics last year because I went on two ayahuasca journeys. And so that plant medicine allowed me to just release all that stuff. But it doesn't mean I'm not interested in people and connection. And I love the idea of looking at the Faroe Islands example. So I'd be genuinely fascinated to follow that story as it comes on. Have you sailed much up in those waters? Have you sailed to Faroes?
Yeah, I've been to Faroe a lot, Tor. I first went when I was, I was just finishing uni at the time, and I went on a university expedition and just fell in love with it. So I went back again as a student. I fished out of Klaksvik for a bit, and I've been back, been really lucky to have been back on holiday and on business many, many times. Sailed up twice with a Swan. So lots of good friends in Faroe. So I must have been in Faroe a dozen times, know it quite well. I find it always incredibly inspirational.
How do you think a vegetarian like me would get on? Because I've been a vegetarian since 2018. I'm thinking that they might not have much in the menu for me.
It's a very modern and very cosmopolitan. It's now a very modern. It always was modern, but it's now a very cosmopolitan place. I mean, clearly, it's a society whose economy and culture is embedded in the sea and in lamb meat. And in whale. So I would guess vegetarianism would still be a bit unusual. But you know what? I think you'd find there's quite a few restaurants now in Faroe, and I guess you'd find, I mean, there will be vegetarians in Faroe. They're not all whale hunters and meat eaters and so on. There's a very, and increasingly a very liberal society. When I first went there, it was probably quite socially conservative. And it was really interesting. They were facing about 10 years ago what Shetland faces, a lot of young people going away to university and not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Shetland's response to that has been live and work in Shetland, just ignore the fact that young people are leaving and not coming back, and then are trying to attract other people to come. So the net result is you get a lot of retirees coming to Shetland, mm-hmm. Selling big houses in London, not really maybe making a great contribution to work in Shetland, because many of them are not working, and then very much, you know, maybe as they get older, increasingly using the services for older people.
Mm-hmm.
In Faroe, they tackled it head on. They went out to all of these thousands of Faroese who went away to uni and weren't returning, saying, look, what do we need to do as a society to make Faroe more attractive? And they had a very interesting, incredible piece of reach out over several years. And a lot of young Faroese were saying, we've got to be a much more progressive society. So the net result of that was that gay marriage was legalized in the Faroe Islands. It became much more liberal in terms of a lot of these social issues. So it's a very modern place now that wouldn't have been the case maybe 20 years ago.
No.
So I think as far as vegetarianism, yeah, no, I think you'd be okay, Todd. What's your reasons for being vegetarian? Is it climate crisis or is it ethics? Or
so here's what happened. Here's the real story. I mean, obviously, my whole life, mum and dad have had that croft, and I was born on the croft on Papa Stewart, and I've seen animals being treated well, and then the cycle of life and eating those animals. And I had a growing awareness over the years of mechanized big agricultural farming, which I just found distasteful. But that didn't prompt me to do anything about it. But I was the guy who would go into a supermarket early on. I've had a number of these conversations in the days before free-range chicken was common, and I would just ask to speak to management and then say, hey, what's the score here? And I would have the conversation with them, and I've convinced a couple of supermarkets to get free-range. And that was years ago, of course. But it was 2015. I was running a writing podcast, and I interviewed people from across the political spectrum. But there was one chap called John King who's written a number of books like Football Factory that were made into movies. But John asked me to review his new book. And the other person that had reviewed it was Irvin Welsh, because he's friends with Irvin Welsh. And I thought, well, I'm honored to be asked to review this. So I went and he sent me a copy of his book, and it's called Slaughterhouse Prayer. And it was really quite a trippy book. It was like a kind of mild acid trip. But basically what he did with this novel is he took me into the animal's perspective. And so by the end of the novel, something had just switched in my brain. And it's not, I don't go around preaching to people, you know, I would still cook somebody's steak if that was their request. You know what I mean? I don't tell other people what to do. I have no issue with other people's habits. But for me, it just switched something. So I haven't eaten meat or fish or anything like that since I finished that book in, I think it was, yeah, it would have been like 1st or 2nd of January 2018. So it kind of, it fits with my previous thoughts about animal welfare in big agriculture. And as I say, I was the guy that would ask in a restaurant, are these free-range eggs, for example? And often people just don't know, which, okay. So yeah, that's what happened, John.
Yeah. I absolutely get that. And it's interesting, the last book I wrote, Salt Roads, which has done quite well, I touch on this whole issue of food choices,
yeah.
and why should we eat certain things. The Salt Roads is a book about Shetland's relationship with the rest of Europe,
yeah.
Told through the prism of fishing and the export of salt fish, which had dominated Shetland's economy and society and culture for 300 years. But I tell the story through not as some tortured economic statistical analysis. I tell the story through the eyes of people I've interviewed. And I also tell the story through how this great tale of sea and exporting and connections with Europe has inspired artists. Mm-hmm. So I opened the book with quite a bit about Halldór Laxness, the wonderful Icelandic novelist, who I don't know if you've ever read Independent People. If you haven't, don't, you shouldn't die before having read Independent People. It's a story of having grown up.
How do you spell the first name, sorry?
Independent People.
Okay.
And it's a story by Halldór Laxness. He won the Nobel Prize for it in 1965. Halldór, H-A-L-D-O-R, Laxness, L-A-K-S-N-E-S, Laxness, Halldór Laxness, Independent People. It's the best, it remains a bestseller. One, it's about crofters and about how crazy crofters become looking after their animals. So as a crofter, I mean, there's, I never grew up in a croft, but if you did, you'll just get that guy. And how, I'll say no more. It's just a delight. It's a wonderfully written book. Anyway, Halldór Laxness is one of the artists who I quote in my book. And I start the book by talking about saltfish. You know, who on earth eats saltfish nowadays? But you forget, I'm coming back to food choices. I'm beginning to ramble. You forget how important saltfish was in the cuisine of Europe before freezers, before just time supply. Yeah. And in another novel, Halldór Laxness, a novel called Salcavalda, he often deals with huge philosophical and moral issues. And in this book called Salcavalda, about a young woman who works salting cod in a village, he deals with issues of feminism and gender way before its time, set in the 1920s. And this village revolves around salt cod. Everybody, the men all catch it, the women all process it, and everybody else works exporting it. And this wonderful phrase in the middle of Laxness' novel, he says, in his very matter-of-fact way, when all is said, life is first and foremost about saltfish. And so that's the kind of opening for my book. So yes. I then deal with Hugh McDermott, Neil Dunn, some Faroese, wonderful Faroese artists. I also feature Fiddler's Bid, who have done some really interesting compositions. I deal with the first documentary made by John Grierson in the 1920s about the herring drifters. So I weave in all of this artistic stuff into my book, The Salt Roads. And then at the end, I wasn't intending to do this. This is where I come back to food choices. But as I researched this book and spoke to people in the modern seafood industry around Europe and the connections with Shetland, I sort of was aware of an increasing sense of frustration within the seafood industry that it was increasingly misunderstood. And I had this experience, which I feature in my book, with two, I call that chapter the Texas Eco Warriors. Mm-hmm. These are two women from a well-known American NGO who I don't name and shame in the book. They weren't vegetarians or anything like that. They were, you know, we had a meeting about discards, you know, the practice of when you trawl off fish, small fish, fish that you don't have quota for, fish for which there's no market, are thrown over the side dead. An inconscionable practice that needs to be stopped. We need to have better fisheries management, better mesh size and all that stuff. But in the meeting we had in London, they were increasingly moralistic and they ended up really with a very hectoring tone saying the fishermen were acting immorally. They were throwing away good quality fish. It was a monumental waste of resources. I agree with all of that. So we went out for dinner in the evening and the atmosphere became more conciliatory. And then I was sitting between them and we all had fish. And then I noticed when the plate was taken away, you would have been brought up as I was. You had to eat everything in your plate. That's how Shetlanders are brought up.
Yeah.
And as Americans from this nation of abundance, they just picked at their fish.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't even eaten quarter of it. And that went back and went in the bin. And I never called them out. And I've been so angry about that. So eventually, I eventually vented that in this chapter in the Salt Book. But towards the end, I then looked at fish and said, okay, we've all got the responsibility to try and save the planet from climate change. And one of the biggest things in terms of carbon footprint is what we eat. And some of the figures for grain-fed beef, you know, feedlots in middle of the States, even in Europe, there's 60 kilos of greenhouse gases released for every kilo of beef produced. It's a lot of that is the methane through, you know, the cows farting and all this kind of stuff. But it's a terrible environmental impact, which has made me think twice about eating beef. Lamb and pork are much better at around 12 to 15 kilos. Chicken is the best. If it's free range, it's about 5. If it's free range, it's about 6 or 7. If it's battery farmed, it's better, but, you know, the ethics are worse. It's about 5. So eating meat, land-based protein, is not great. However, if you look at fish, it's incredibly low. Trawled fish is about as high as you get. Bottom trawled fish, about 2.5. Farmed salmon and farmed sea bream and sea bass is about 3.5 to 4. So much less than any land-based protein. And then if you look at trawled mackerel, it's 0.9. Mm-hmm. If you look at farmed mussels, it's 0.2. So incredibly low carbon footprint for all kinds of seafood, whether farmed or caught. And that's to do with the fact it's a cold-blooded creature, so you don't take up energy to keep it warm, and all kinds of reasons. So in terms of food choices, eating seafood, there's a lot to be said from an environmental perspective, that if you eat seafood and don't eat any land-based protein, it's better for the planet. And there's some really good work being done by several scientists, but somebody called Frances Sanders, and should be younger than you, Tor. She'd be in her 30s, Shetland lass, and she's done a PhD on this. And the pescatarian diet in terms of carbon footprint is very similar to a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet in terms of, you know, not the ethics, but the carbon footprint. So that's a very long and tortuous way to say I deal with this whole issue of food choices in salt roads.
And I'm glad you took us back to boats, because you're talking about fishing, because I would like to know, have you got a boat? Have you got your own sailing boat?
I do. We've had a sailboat for, I think, a dozen years now. Yeah. Motor sailor. Been to Norway in our once, been to Scotland in our couple of times, been down to Orkney a few times, and just around Shetland. So we're hoping to do more with her. This summer, we're hoping to go back to Papa and then up to Bray and maybe go around Shetland this summer.
What size?
She's 34 feet. She's a Fisher, 34.
Oh, yeah, I know what that is. I looked at, and I would have bought, but to get a marine survey out of the water, just it defeated me in the end. I was trying to buy a Colvick Watson 24-foot.
Oh, they're a lovely boat. Yeah.
He sat over just outside Fort William, and the guy selling it was a really cool guy. We had great conversations, went for a trip on her and everything, and it just agreed a price, just could not get a flipping survey. Couldn't get a crane in the same place as the marine surveyor and the owner and me all on the same day. It just defeated me. So anyway, I've ended up not buying her at the moment, but I think she's still there. So a motor sailor would be my preference too. But if you're in Papastour in the summer, like, let's connect, because I want to be there most of the summer. So
absolutely, do that, Tor. Absolutely, that's our plan. Maybe we're not doing next year. We've kind of been the last few years. Our boating's been very restricted because we had a very old golden retriever that we couldn't leave with anybody else. So, but she sadly died in August last year. September last year. So we're kind of free now. Girls are away, so we're kind of May, June time. We're hoping to set out. So we'll do that, absolutely. I'll tell you a wonderful story about Papa Stewart that you'll remember. George, the late George Peterson.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
He was a teacher.
Legend. Yeah.
And I remember once, years and years ago, when Barbara Crawford did their first excavation at Papa and brought out, I think for the first time into the public mind, how important Papa was in Viking Shetland, the excavations. She was doing a talk at Aylesbury, and I went, I think my wife and I both, we went into here, and George P.S. Peterson was doing the introduction, and he stood up and said, well, I'm from Papa Stewart, grew up there and still got the cross there. And he says, you know, and he must have been waiting all his life to tell this story. He says, you know, he says, when I was 11 years old, I had to leave Papa and go and stay in the hostel in Lerwick, which is where I stayed before the bridge came to Burra and where you stayed. And my first day at the Institute, the Anderson, as it was called at that time, we had to do the register class. You maybe even experienced the same thing. And he says, the person doing the register, you know, ask the name, where you came from. And he was a proud of Papa Stewart. You know, we'd grown up there and with all the history and all the crofting memories from a young age, as you would have. And so he proudly said, my name is George, whatever PS stands for, George P.S. Peterson, and I come from Papa Stewart. And this registered teacher in this miss of fashion said, oh, George Papa Stewart, that must be the back of beyond. Typical Lerwegian, small-minded attitude. And he says, now, he says, Dr. Barbara Crawford, in her excavations, has demonstrated that Papa had a central and important role in Viking Shetland at a time when nobody even stayed in there.
So how about we make Papa Stewart the center of the new Shetland Viking world as we get independence for Shetland and get go and join the Nordic nations? I'm on board, mate. I'm on board. Let's do it.
And all the Nordic nations have something called the Nordic House, which there's one in Oslo, one in Reykjavik, one in Tórshavn, and they've got them. And so if Shetland ever aspires to become and becomes greater autonomy and aspires to that, I mean, Faroe has a Nordic house. It's not independent. So Shetland, even if it wasn't fully independent, but had an enhanced degree of autonomy, could perhaps have a Nordic house. Where better to cite that on where Barbara did her excavations? So George had been waiting, I think, to tell that story.
Yeah.
To redress the balance between Lerwick and Papa. Wonderful. I just love it. And that's, it was no big deal, but to me, having been at the hostel and sort of experienced that kind of disdainful, condescending attitude that many Lerwegians have to what they call the country, and especially to places like Papa. You would have known, I was at the hostel with, he died a couple of years ago, Jimison. It's Gordon Tunison.
Yes. From Papa, you mean?
Yeah, from Papa.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
from the hospital with Gordon. And his son, I forget his son.
Tommy.
Yeah. He works the land now. So when we were in Papa last summer or summer before, then we met Tommy on his tractor. And, so it was. So it's good to see that the crofts are still, being worked by the families. And, you know, Tommy spends, you know, like you do, quite a bit of time there. So although the population of Papa's low in the winter, during the summer, it's, you know, it's a lot bigger.
Yeah, it's still, I would say it's still got a certain energy about it. And I would certainly like to see that continue. So although I'm no crofting expert, I really enjoy how sociable it is, because Mum and Dad have over the years developed this thing where they have like volunteers from the WOOF organization, like organic farm volunteers, come from all over the world. And it's fascinating because you meet these, like it's kind of a mini crossroads of the world. They've had like Han Chinese people, lots of Americans, Europeans, New Zealanders, Australians. And so the dinner table from like, well, from February to October, November, to be honest, because there were some woofers there when I was up from France just a few weeks ago. The dinner table is like the United Nations in terms of the like the people who turn up there and the fascinating conversations. So yeah, I love the place more and more the older I get, and I certainly plan to spend more time there. Listen, John, I've just seen the time. I'm going to have to go in a minute. So have you got any final thoughts or anywhere that people can go and connect with you that you could share?
Delighted to have this chat. Delighted to be on the podcast. Yeah, I mean, my life has been spent as a Shetlander. Really lucky. I've worked in the seafood industry in many capacities. I still do that. I'm still passionate about seafood, but as we've been discussing with the Salt Roads, I've written this book, and I've kind of discovered the joy of writing. I've always read. So I am planning these two new books. I'm working on the next one, which will be about the seafood industry and the environmental movement. And the one after that, which I'm also working on, is Shetland's kind of historical place in the North Atlantic politics of the future, of which Pab Stewart will, I promise you, feature very heavily.
Nice one. And where can people connect with you, though? Have you got a website people can visit?
I haven't got a website. I probably should have a website. But, you know, you can find me. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn, John Goodlad, Shetland. And I'm also contactable by WhatsApp and email, all of the usual stuff. But you've reminded me, a lot of people have said I should have a website, which, you know, people who are interested maybe in my books and what I'm saying can go, and then I could have a blog. So that's something I've started to think about, and I probably should have, given where the modern world is. But I'm contactable on all of these other platforms and would be delighted to hear from anybody who's interested in any of these subjects or who might have read my books and want to find out more.
Superb. Thanks, John. I'll catch you up during the summer. Cheers.
We'll hopefully catch up with you. Great.
Yeah. Great. Bye. Stuff. Bye now.